Ryan Williams, MP, Bay of Quinte. Inflation is causing Canadians' money to go jiggle, jiggle, not fold. Inflation makes you wiggle, wiggle, for sure. Grocers, gas, and households. You know, it was meant to be. You see it everywhere these days. At your grocery store, the gas pump, and your retail purchases. I did a spoof of inflation this week. It was called Just Inflation, off of a popular TikTok video that talks about what the Conservative Party has proposed for solutions and relief to Canadians from inflation, which includes knocking off the carbon tax and GST for gasoline, killing the tariffs for our farmers, which is costing more to grow food, repairing supply chain bottlenecks, but more importantly, incentivizing Canadian companies to produce more of the stuff that money buys and to stop printing money, which drives inflation. Today, we will jiggle our way into the inflationary conversation. What has really caused inflation? Why did the banks get it all wrong? Why is gas so high? And diesel? And what's next? What natural resources are we developing? And can Canada hit net zero with high gas and inflation? What's next for interest rates? And housing? And are we headed for a recession? And what is next for the real estate bubble? We're going to give you an update from our Quinte District Association of Realtors. Today, we will talk to conservative critic Dan Albus for finance. We're going to talk to conservative critic Greg McLean from Natural Resources. Farmer, my colleague and MP Damian Couric from Alberta. And former president of QDAR, Don McCool. All of this, your inflationary worries, the conversation and the debate on In the House.
Mr. Speaker, it's my pleasure to rise as the first time as Conservative MP for the Bay of Quinte.
This is the In the House podcast with your voice in the House of Commons, Bay of Quinte MP Ryan Williams.
Inflation is raging out of control, reaching 4.5%. It's now the highest level since almost two decades. Furthermore, the price of the essentials that low-income Canadians require is rising the fastest. For example, housing is up a third, as are gas prices. Food is reaching double-digit increases, especially nutritious food. These are the basics. These are not luxuries, and they form a larger part of the budgets of low-income Canadians.
That was then Conservative finance critic Pierre Poilievre talking about inflation on November 14th, 2021. Now, remember, that was still 3 months before Russia invaded Ukraine. But what was causing inflation prior to Ukraine? We're talking today to Conservative finance critic Dan Albus. Dan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ryan. It's great to be here with you. I'm a big fan of the work you're doing, particularly when you put the spotlight on military families trying to help find housing, obviously helping the tourism sector in your riding, among other things. Your speech on the need for government policy to empower constituents I thought was great, and I think it really reflects well on your Bay of Quinte constituents.
What has caused inflation in Canada?
Well, inflation is the number one financial issue for Canadians. We've been studying this at the Finance Committee, and Greg Peterson, the Assistant Chief Statistician at Statistics Canada, told us, and I quote, "We haven't seen gains this large in 30 years. The price increases are broad-based, with the biggest drivers being gasoline, food, supply chain issues, and a heated housing market," end quote. So when we're speaking about inflation, there's a host of factors. Some are within the control of government, some not. Now, things like labor shortages, Ryan. Hello, we've known for well over a decade that starting in 2015, baby boomers would start to retire. Now, the old saying goes, demographics is destiny. Others were known, like supply chain issues, whether they be closed ports in Shanghai due to COVID or issues with the Port of Vancouver or overlooked, for example, the pent-up demand as consumers had saved and then wanted to spend as the economy reopened from COVID. But look, we also have to see the choices taken by government. Bill Robson, who's the president of the C.D. Howe Institute, said to the Finance Committee during our study of inflation, and I quote, "Many advanced economies have inflation rates similar to ours, not because it's inevitable, but because they did similar things in reacting to the pandemic. Choices about monetary policy and fiscal policy got us here. and we are in control of those choices in the future. To elaborate the point, energy and food are expensive everywhere. Supply chains are stretched everywhere, but inflation isn't the same everywhere. It's in double digits in some countries, with Argentina and Turkey as examples. It's above 1,000% in Venezuela. It's about 2% in Switzerland, and it's less than 1% in Japan. Inflation is high where monetary policy has been inflationary, and it is low where it has not been. We're seeing inflation now above our 2% target because our response to the pandemic overshot.
Dan, did the Bank of Canada get it all wrong then?
It seems to me that it swung from one crisis to another, from the proverbial COVID-19 frying pan into an inflationary fire. By choosing to keep rates low and purchasing government bonds until April, the bank chose a path that is inflationary by default. Now, after the bank's decision to start raising interest rates, Stephen Tapp, economist at the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, tweeted in April, quote, "The nominal rate, 1%, is still below the bank's estimate of the neutral, 2 to 3%. Until its rate rises above 2 to 3%, the bank is pouring gas on the inflationary fire." End quote. But it's not just the bank that's stoking inflation. The decision by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Minister of Finance Chrystia Freeland to inject $100 billion of so-called stimulus into the Canadian economy is making it worse. More money chasing less goods only fuels inflation.
Dan, inflation is a global phenomenon, but what could Canada have done sooner and better?
As Statistics Canada said, Ryan, the drivers of inflation largely are energy, groceries, and housing. So usually the answer to high prices are prices themselves. For example, on energy, we have the third largest reserves in the world. Usually the answer to higher energy prices is for energy companies to expand their production. That's, again, supply being enlarged when demand is high. This largely isn't happening as many companies look at the wall of red tape and process that can take years for them to solve. On the issue of groceries, until recently, the government was pushing front of package labeling that industry said would have cost billions of dollars to implement, which would have been simply passed on to consumers. Now, the same thing goes for new regulations and tariffs on fertilizers, which makes it harder for farmers to do what they do best. All of these things, Ryan, are inflationary. Policies for example, like the carbon tax, according to the governor of the Bank of Canada, are inflationary. Likewise, the new fuel standard the government is bringing in is projected to increase the cost of fuel by 11 to 16 cents. So those tractors don't power themselves. All of these policies add up, whether at the farm cellar door, the grocery store, and especially at the kitchen table. So I won't get too much into housing, Ryan, other than to say that if one level of government constrains the supply of housing while adding new development costs, while another pumps more money into an asset class, whether it be monetary easing, low interest rates, crown corporations that buy out mortgage-heavy banks, it should be no surprise that it attracts higher consumption and speculation. Now, we heard of this again from Professor Deja at our committee, and I'll quote, "Quite simply, when you flood the financial system with all of that cash and you drive interest rates down almost to zero and signal that they're going to stay at zero or low for a long time to come, it really dries up credible investment opportunities in the real economy because basically money is free to borrow. What that does is drive all of that cash into different kinds of asset markets, stock markets. Even during the pandemic, we're reaching highs."
Thank you very much, Dan. Look, it's easy to be a critic after the fact. However, you have to look at monetary and fiscal policies through a historic lens. Printing more money that the markets have needed always means more money chasing fewer goods, which drives prices up. The NDP had a proposal this week, which was to give every Canadian $1,000 to combat inflation. It seems absolutely ludicrous that the exact same money that's causing inflation will then be used to solve it. And the question no one asked was, where's that money coming from? And how much is that going to cost us in the long term? We have to continue to work hard at monetary and fiscal policies that first quell inflation and to ensure we really look hard at how to prevent this from happening in the future. Greg McLean is the Conservative Natural Resource Critic. Greg, great to have you on the show. Let's talk about Canadian oil and gas. Why are Canadian gas prices so high today? And before the Ukraine war, they were rising. Will gas prices go down, Greg?
Will gas go down? Yes. Will gas go up again? Yes. But look at what we are paying for gas at the pumps. And a good portion of that, of course, is government revenues, both at the consumer level, so both where we see it at the pump, but also built into the margins that we think the oil and gas refiners are taking. In effect, they have had a whole bunch of regulation thrust upon them, including the Clean Fuel Standard, that make it more expensive to actually refine the product and deliver it to customers. So we have built in higher cost gas in Canada. Think about this. 7 years ago, the last time oil, from which gas is derived, was trading at about the same level in world markets, we were paying about $1.40 Canadian per liter in Canada. Now we've been paying $2.10 per liter average. So the significant difference there, of course, is government take, economic rent, as they say, where governments are trying to get more and more. But believe me, one of the issues here, of course, is that the issue around a carbon tax is carbon taxes are meant to make the consumption of this good more expensive. That's built into the design. So anytime somebody sees we need a carbon tax, the carbon taxes that we need to make this product artificially more expensive because we want people to consume less of it. And that is the design. And that's, you know, understood why somebody will want that, but that it does have an effect on consumers, and that does have an effect on inflation, and that does have an effect in the grocery stores and everything that gets distributed in Canada. So there's our problem, is that you can't just say this is the one solution without it having a whole bunch of effects throughout society. And I think the government is just starting to figure that out.
Greg, can we hit net zero in today's inflationary economy? And what does the future of net zero look like?
When you talk about net zero, I think people have to think about what that means, net zero. So net zero is a construct that somebody's going to have to come up with at the end of the day. And the governments involved are going to be in the process of designing that paradigm for quite some time. So getting to net zero is attainable if the people making the rules are writing the rules appropriately. For instance, let's get right on the ground there about what we're talking about. Last summer, I ran into somebody here in Alberta, and their way of actually getting to net zero included driving around and paying farmers for having fallow fields. Now, these are fields that were already fallow before these government assessors or contractors making money actually went and gave these credits to these farmers. Now, I have nothing against farmers getting credit for their fallow fields. However, there is no reduction in CO2 for actually paying people for having fallow fields that they were going to have anyways. Now, this is part of the construct the government comes up with. Likewise, with the whole thing on a so-called carbon trading mechanism, we have to look at the rules on that carbon trading mechanism and what it actually means for reduction in real CO2. So net zero as a construct is feasible because somebody's making the rules to make it feasible. What we really need to do in the current context of what's happening in the world is reduce CO2 emissions. And that's not going to be easy. It's going to cost money. It's going to be an effort. It's going to require a whole bunch of new technology, much of which we need to move towards. And like my carbon capture and sequestration bill in the last parliament that the Liberals, NDP, and Bloc Québécois all voted down, it's a way of incrementally reducing the CO2 and actually capturing it and putting it underground so it's in storage. These are real solutions, not constructed solutions that aren't going to help the environment, supposedly. They're actual real solutions in reducing CO2 in the atmosphere. So those are, I mean, I think our party really looks towards what are the real solutions here rather than what are the government design solutions that are really leading us nowhere as far as environmental advancements goes. So there's a long-winded answer for this whole concept around net zero. But I think the takeaway for all the listeners is Net zero requires a definition, and that definition is going to be set by the people making the rules.
Could exporting Canada's natural gas help with the world energy crisis?
Our natural gas exports are the number one way we can help the world reduce its CO2 emissions. You take a look around the world, and you know I'm a data-focused person, and the amount of extra coal, I mean, the coal's gone up by 10%, in the world consumption this past year, and that's because the economy is coming back, and the countries that are burning coal as their power source don't have other options. Now, we know natural gas has a carbon footprint about half that of coal. So getting Canadian natural gas to world markets to help those countries that are developing have a power source with half the carbon footprint of the power source that they are choosing is fundamental for actually fixing the environmental problems the world is facing, because people are going to require power here going forward. Every country in the world is looking for how they're going to power their economies. We look at it because, you know, I know the environmentalists in Canada all talk about it. Well, we will up our emissions by producing more natural gas in Canada. Yes, we will. But by exporting it, we're actually reducing that, the CO2 emissions around the world substantially. So we've got to stop having such a parochial view of this environment, because the environment, especially the atmosphere, of course, it goes all around the globe. It's not like you can emit more CO2 in Asia, and we're not going to feel the effects of it all around the globe. So yes, our number one solution for helping the world's environment is to get Canadian gas offshore as quickly as possible.
Let's talk about hydrogen and nuclear energy. What does the future look like?
Hydrogen, nuclear energy, I've looked at all of these. I'm big on nuclear energy because it's a devil we know. We know how to regulate this very well. Hydrogen's something that's further down the pipe. I know there's a bunch of industrial uses for hydrogen right now. And I look at the government of Alberta and their efforts with hydrogen. But you look at the regulatory environment around natural gas, which hydrogen is going to displace at a higher cost than natural gas, I should point out. But it's going to require potentially new pipeline infrastructure. And, you know, we have difficulty getting pipelines built in Canada because of the current regulatory constraints imposed by this government. So new infrastructure is going to be required. New regulations are going to be required with hydrogen as well, because, the regulations had to be designed around natural gas as we evolved into that power source. And it's a very important power source, natural gas, for fuel in Canada. About one third of the power in Canada, including heat and industrial power, is provided by natural gas. For Canadians, it's a very important power source. The issue around that whole regulatory environment spills over to nuclear, because I've had people talk to us about lessening the regulatory environment around nuclear to make things move more quickly. I'm not in favor of that. I think we've got a robust regulatory environment around nuclear. We just have to get going. You look at it, there's very few new power sources that are on the books right now that are going to take a 10-year horizon before they're actually going to be built. And 10 years is 10 years of power that we don't have, and we need to grow our power options in Canada in all respects. Natural gas, nuclear, hydrogen is one of the new entrants, but like I say, we're figuring that one out, and hopefully it goes into that portfolio of power mixes the country needs going forward here.
We are in an energy crisis, and Canada has the stuff, the energy, to solve it. But it'll take long-term planning and being smart about what is A, affordable to Canadians, B, void of any security threats like war, and C, attainable. Hydrogen is many years away, so how do we gradually get there while meeting our energy needs today? Energy is very important for our families, for our farmers, and for your affordability, and we need to solve that crisis now. Food prices are at all-time highs. A simple trip to the grocery store can cost up to 30% more for the average Canadian. In Bay of Quinte, we've seen food bank usage go up as high as 30%. So farmers are extremely important. I'm happy to welcome a farmer today, my colleague, MP Damien Kirk, a farmer in Alberta. Damien, thank you for being here. Why is food inflation up so high?
Thanks, Ryan, for the opportunity to join you on your podcast this month. You know, you asked a question about food inflation, and it's a very important one because food inflation is one of those factors about inflation that affects everybody, but has a whole host of causes, both directly and indirect. A lot of it has to do with the rising cost associated with supply chains. So, for example, when the price of fuel increases, the cost to get food from the farm to the processing facility, from the processing facility to the warehouse, and from the warehouse to the grocery store, all of those costs are increased. And therefore, when a consumer goes to the grocery store, their costs are increased as well. There's costs of production, things like fertilizer that a farmer needs to help grow the high quality and quantity of food that is required to feed the world. The costs for that have more than doubled over the past year or so. When it comes to things like the carbon tax, that is a inflationary pressure that impacts everything from things like fertilizer to every aspect of the food supply chain. So when it comes to food inflation, we've seen prices on average increase about 10%, some products significantly higher than that. And it has had a huge impact on the affordability of being able to buy those high quality groceries that Canadians have come to expect and that we are blessed to be able to access in our country. It's very unfortunate that even though Conservatives have brought forward some practical measures to help combat these inflationary pressures, the Liberal NDP coalition every step of the way has said no. And the sad reality is they want higher prices. Chrystia Freeland this month, a number of times, has said things like it takes commitment to keep prices high to transition to a green economy. She is bragging about their increase on things like the cost of fuel to fulfill their political agenda. That's not what Canadians deserve, and certainly Conservatives have and will continue to fight against that, because there is no question that there is an affordability crisis in this country as we speak. It's not something that's coming. There are many Canadians that are having to make the decision as to whether or not they buy high-quality food or lower-quality food, whether or not they can even afford to buy groceries. Hearing heartbreaking stories of some Canadians that have to go hungry so that their family, so that their kids can eat. And that is not acceptable in our country. Conservatives have been working hard to try and do something about it. It is a national shame that the Liberals have pushed back every step of the way.
Damien, the Conservatives have talked about eliminating tariffs for farmers. Would this help, and why would it?
The question about fertilizer tariffs is a tough one, because Conservatives absolutely stand with the people of Ukraine and support the imposition of tariffs on Russian-produced goods and products. And so when it comes to the talk about Conservatives wanting to address things like fertilizer tariffs, there's two important aspects to that. One, Canada can and should be producing these products ourselves. Canada has a world-class resource sector, whether it's in our energy sector, the production of natural gas, which is a primary component to nitrogen-based fertilizer, which is essential for agriculture, whether it be our mining, which is where potash comes from. Canada can and should be leading the world in terms of making sure that there is a strong, stable, and secure supply of things like fertilizer. Now, the second part, and this gets pretty complicated, but Canadians have learned over the course of the last number of months since Russia invaded Ukraine is that the many farmers, farm suppliers in eastern Canada, and this also impacts many other jurisdictions as well, including the eastern United States, many places, many jurisdictions in Europe. The most prevalent supplier of many of the products required for farming, things like fertilizer, come from Russia. And the impact of tariffs on those products is significant. Now, there is a case to be made that there has to be consequences for the actions of Russia, and a 35%, I believe, is the number tariff on these Russian-produced goods is certainly justified. But what conservatives have called for is to say, look, at prior to the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, there were many contracts that had been signed by suppliers, by companies, by farmers, where that may have involved Russian products at some point in the supply chain. It is absolutely essential that farmers be able to access those goods and services. Every other developed nation has provided that exemption. So after the invasion, of course, there needs to be that tariff to ensure that Russia is held to account for their unprovoked and unjustified invasion of Ukraine. But when it comes to farmers and agricultural producers, that key element of those who signed a contract in good faith, not knowing that there would be a war, they need to be able to access those products as well, because the consequences of not means what could be a 35% or more increase, and in some cases not even being able to access the fertilizers and goods that are required for them to grow their crops and whatnot. And that can have a significant impact on their bottom lines, but also add to the inflationary pressures that are being faced when it comes to things like the rising cost of food and groceries and things like that. So there's two parts to this. One, Canada can and should be a leader in making sure that there is a strong, available, secure supply chain when it comes to everything related to farm products, things like fertilizer. But also, we need to ensure that our policies reflect the reality that producers are facing and don't simply penalize farmers and producers in Canada when the rest of the world has made that very, very clear distinction, saying contracts signed before the illegal invasion of Ukraine versus after. There needs to be that clear differentiation, and conservatives have endeavored to highlight that. Again, this is another one of those issues, very, very practical, should be something where there is cross-partisan support. Unfortunately, the Liberals seem to have dismissed these very, very valid concerns, and whether they are ignorant to or simply don't understand the impact of these sorts of policy decisions on both our agricultural sector, which I represent, a rural area of Alberta that has a lot of agricultural producers, but also the impact that this has on Canadians' bottom lines when it comes to things like being able to afford groceries at the grocery store. The impacts can be very, very significant.
Damien, can Canada produce more food?
The simple answer to whether or not Canada can produce more food is yes. We absolutely can. And Canadian producers, the agricultural sector within our nation, has led the world in terms of being able to ensure that no matter what the weather conditions, no matter what the circumstances, we can produce a high-quality product in an environmentally sustainable way. I'm very, very proud to represent an area of the country where we do that incredibly well. I am the fifth generation to be involved in my family farm, where we grow crops like wheat and canola and other cereals. And I'm incredibly proud of the work and the science that goes into the production of crops and farms like mine. But then across the country, we also have the ability, both through innovation and technological advancement, to ensure that Canada has a secure food supply chain for things like produce, fruits and vegetables, to ensure that things like protein, meat, and other types of proteins, there's that strong food supply chain. Canada has led the world on this, and we can continue. But one of the things that we have to be able to ensure is that we get the government out of the way. Recently, the Liberals have been toying around with the idea of imposing a mandated restriction in the amount of fertilizer that a farmer can use for their crops. This is a terrible idea. They do not understand that the messing with things like that will have a significant impact on Canada's ability to not only produce a high-quality agricultural product, but also will have the devastating impact of being able to produce more of the food that the world needs, especially when it appears that we are going into a global food crisis where there are going to be massive shortages around the world, and the consequences of that are very, very significant. Canada can and should be leading the way. It's unfortunate that the Liberals' policy direction, whether it's through things like the carbon tax, the talk of mandated fertilizer reductions, their unwillingness to move on pre-invasion tariffs, making sure that we have exemptions carved out so that farmers and ranchers and producers can do simply what they do best, which is grow and produce, raise the animals, make sure that Canada has the best food supply chain in the world, that it's strong, that it's secure, and that our producers lead the way in that. And to emphasize this for all of your listeners, Ryan, Canada's been doing this incredibly well. We can continue and expand that so that we continue to meet some of the demands that are required, and through innovation, through our universities, through colleges, through some not-for-profits and development programs, Canada's also been able to export some of the technology that we've been able to utilize in our country to help make sure that other nations around the world can likewise have strong food supply chains. Canada can and is leading the world. It's just too bad that we don't have a government that supports our agricultural producers in the way that they should be. And it's further unfortunate that there are times where it seems like the policy decisions that the Liberals are making are based more on misinformation than the facts and the reality on the ground. Let's trust our farmers and ranchers to get the job done, because they've been doing a great job so far. And as long as we provide them the tools they need, get out of the way so that they can do their job correctly, we will have that strong food supply chain, which benefits not only Canada, but the entire world.
Mayor Harrison says a lot of things very often. Quinny West is the best for one. But he also says almost every week, and I really agree with this, if you've eaten today, thank a farmer. We also need to look after our own food bank usage, including the Cleaners Food Bank, is up over 30%. And that seems to correlate with grocery prices that have risen almost the same. You know, if you would like to help your local food banks here, please donate cash. And you can bring checks to their organizations, or please volunteer to help. They need volunteers. And that's something that as we get into the winter months, we'll need more help with. But let's make sure we support our farmers, make sure that we support our food banks. And for food inflation, as the government and the critic of the government, we're going to be trying to find solutions to make more food. Housing is still red hot, but has it cooled? And what are inflation and rising interest rates going to do to the market? Welcome to Don McCool, past president of QDAR.
Is the market slowing? I would say yes, it is. The average price has even come down. We're in June, it was just under $655,000, although that is significantly higher than June of 2019 when it was $365,000. But we're getting more listings come on the market. In June, there was 706 listings, which compared to last year of 635, that's helped out. So we now have, at the end of June, had 831 listings on the market, which is much better than what we had back in January, which the end of January, there was only 176. So activity, yes, has slowed. We're not seeing 20 offers on most properties. Now we're, you know, you're seeing a few, so there is some multiple offer situations, but it definitely has slowed.
What will rising interest rates do to the market?
Rising interest rates have had an impact. Some people have been thinking maybe they should jump in now before they go too high or decide on making a change, and others have been sitting and waiting. I think the bigger impact with interest rates is going to be a few years from now when people have to renew their mortgages and their interest rate is double, triple what they have been used to for a lot of years, and suddenly their mortgage payments are going to be significantly higher. So I think the bigger impact on interest rates is going to be down the road.
What does the industry see for an outlook this year?
Outlook for the year? That's always the toughest question. I think this year we're going to see more of a typical summer, July and August, where it slows down. I haven't seen that the last couple of years with COVID and the way that the market's gone, but This year seems to be heading that way, so I would maybe expect the fall to pick back up a little bit for as far as sales are concerned, and then into December slow down again. But that's always just a guess. You never know. This year looks so different than the last two, and they look just different than what we've seen almost any time in the industry. So it's always a guess.
What does our rental market look like?
The rental market, I think it's almost a tougher market than for people who have been looking to buy. I don't think it's slowed down any yet, though. Anybody that has been looking to rent a house or a unit, apartment or anything, they put out an ad and they seem to have 20, 30, 50 people looking. So as far as if you have a place to rent, it's easy for you to find somebody. For the people looking to rent, I know lots of people have been frustrated. They've been extremely hard to find a new place. And if they're, say they have a growing family and they need something bigger, it's just been costing them more and more. So I don't see that changing anytime soon.
How do you see the housing market being fixed?
Fixing the housing market. That's probably the toughest question out there. Supply and demand, though. On the supply side, we need all three levels of government to work together to remove some of the restrictions, speed up the process. And that as much means we need provincially and federally to push the municipalities to do just that. And not just building new subdivisions, but infilling. There's lots of neighborhoods where you could divide a lot and add in another home, and that would help increase the supply. On the demand side, we need to slow down the number of people coming in to look for homes. Immigration is great. The country needs that. But if you haven't first increased the supply of homes for these people to live in, we end up with a market that we've had the last 2 years. There's just not enough houses for sale and not enough homes being built to fill the demand. And that's where we are now.
Inflation is no joke. We need to take it seriously and start to tackle every bit of it with the seriousness it needs. That includes making more stuff, including food and housing. It means stopping printing money. It's the invisible tax that Canadians are paying for every day, and its effects could put millions of Canadians into poverty. It must be made a priority. It's important to me to always be here listening to you and act as your voice in the House of Commons as we tackle big issues and find solutions to ensure we're looking after you and your families. I want to thank my guests who joined today, Conservative finance critic Dan Elbus, Conservative natural resources critic Greg McLean, MP Damian Kirk, and former president of the Quinte District Association of Realtors, Don McCool. You could reach our office anytime at 613-969-3300 or ryan.williams@parl.gc.ca. I want to thank In Quinte for producing this production. Every month or every 2 months, we look at a new issue and we make sure we talk about it. And we're here listening and representing you. I'll see you next time as your member of parliament, Ryan Williams, in the House.